Welcome, friends, to the Generations Radio broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you today. Homeschool father of five, raising our children out here in the eastern plains of Colorado. Son Daniel in studio with me, working on our family oikonomia as we broadcast from my basement. And ladies and gentlemen, today we want to talk about the family economy and preserving it from the socialist governments, the statism that continually drives a wedge into the family and disintegrates the family educationally, economically, and every other way. And folks, it's my perspective that the present economic system, the present statist socialist system, is exercising economic jihad on the family and doing what it can to rip it apart at the seams. And folks, the family has been falling apart economically and disintegrating economically since the 1970s, perhaps even earlier than that. But we have twice as many moms working outside of the home as were in 1970. Friends, twice as many in percentage-wise as were working back in 1970. That's a huge, huge increase in just 35 to 40 years. And according to economists, this is not necessarily a good thing for families. Listen to this. For a fairly modest income family, the marginal tax rate for the very first dollar from the second paycheck can be 33% or higher, depending on how much the first paycheck is. And that's only counting federal taxes. Even for middle-income earners, state income taxes can range from 0% in states like Florida and Texas up to 9.55% in states like California. Living in the Golden State might end up increasing your combined marginal tax rate for the second earner to an eye-popping 42%. Throw in disability as well as employee-related expenses such as parking, and nearly half of the income from the second paycheck can get eaten up by taxes and work-related expenses. Now, we haven't even looked at child care yet. Child care, average child care price tag right now in America, $8,150 per child. That's $8,150 per child. And if you're trying to be an average family that breaks the birth imploding 2.0 and you're up to 3.0, that's $24,000 in child care for three children. Add to that, of course, car expenses, paying for gas, maintenance, wear and tear, a 30-mile round-trip commute, and that's a rather short commute, will cost about $3,500 per year. Additionally, you got to consider home-related expenses that may go up as the second job creates the need to outsource cleaning or maintenance. Brown bagging lunch can be pretty boring. A lot of people give up on brown bagging the lunch, especially if they're a two-income family. Not enough time to prepare lunches. Nobody packing the nice little lunch with a love note inside. So you eat out a whole lot more. The average family eats out about $4,000 per year for the average family in America. And, of course, the average working family would be higher than that, close to $6,000 to $8,000 per year. Now, so far, we're up to what, $35,000 pre-taxes? That's a lot of money, friends. And, of course, tax-wise, toss in another $20,000, $30,000, and you've eaten up the entire paycheck. And indeed, that is what is happening, friends. Remember, 1970, only 34% of the economy went to government. Now it's up to 63%. That is 63% of the GNI goes to government spending somewhere, somehow, somewhat, somewhere around America. That's twice the GNI. Twice the percentage of the GNI being consumed in government spending today as was in 1970. Also, household income has increased since 1970 thanks to more moms in the house workplace, and that's a no-brainer. Yeah, household incomes adjusted for inflation way higher today than it was in 1970 because moms are out there doing the work, twice as many moms out there working. But, of course, the reason for this is that taxes have doubled, and house prices, listen to this, house prices as a percentage of the median household income is up 2.5 times since 1970. Okay, a little more square footage, yes, but hey, the cost of building, et cetera, cost of bank loans, cost of all the mortgage sharks coming down and trying to impose more and more and more money upon the average household. Friends, we're looking at a massive, massive increase in taxes, house prices. And they're not coming out making any more or saving any more. Now, why did we want our daughters going to college and getting a career for the second income? And that is accomplishing what for us since 1970? I'm trying to remember why we were doing all of that. Still trying to remember why were we trying to get the double incomes going so that we can get 64%, no, make that 85% of kids under six in a latchkey condition such that, of course, that 90% of young men won't be grown up by 30 years of age, up from 30% in 1970. That's the vision. That's what the world's doing around us. Yet more than 60% of families with children under 18 now have parents employed outside the home, as I just mentioned. Over 60%. It's approaching more closer to 70% now. Now, 1970, listen to this, friends. This is the clincher. In 1970, the one-income family saved 11% of its take-home pay. On one measly stinking income, they were saving 11% on average and allocated only 1.4% of its annual income to pay revolving debts like credit cards. Well, now in 2005, okay, whereas in 1970, they were saving 11%. In 2005, that two-income family, saving nothing. Nothing. Zero. A big old fat zero. The savings rate's been nothing for the last 4 or 5 years, and they've allocated 15% of their annual income to revolving debt like credit cards. Okay, so are we doing any better off today than we were in 1970 now that we've sent hundreds of millions of girls off to college and we've got hundreds of millions of households doing the dual income thing now? Now we're way more in debt and we're not saving anything. Okay, compared to 1970. Are we better off today? Answer the question, friends. Is the average family better off today than they were in 1970? No way, no way, no way, no way, no way. Of course, way more kids born without fathers. Of course, way more single parent households. Of course, of course, of course, of course. Are we better off today than we were in 1970? Not just socially. Socially, we're a disaster. No, I'm talking economically. Is the average family better off today than they were in 1970? Answer the question. According to the results I'm getting here, friends, I'm not seeing any improvement. I'm seeing things way worse, way worse. Average income family, one income family in 1970 saving 11%. Today, the average two income family, zero. They're not saving anything. You're losing the rat race. If you're in that rat race and you're just going to play the way the average family is educated, the average family is functioning economically, you're going to lose. You're going to lose. You're going to lose. Well, now, the larger concern isn't any of this. The larger concern is inheritance, because a good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children. And by the way, you don't do that with 0% savings rates and eating up 15% of your annual income in revolving debt. Okay, that doesn't happen. You're not saving an inheritance for your children's children if that's the kind of thing that's happening. So here's what happens to us, though. After a lifetime of working to scrape together a tiny inheritance for your children, after paying 50 to 60% of your income in taxes, sales tax, property tax, income tax, 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 tax. Okay, after 50 to 60% of your income is going off to taxes, and after paying 5%, after getting your 5% interest and yet paying taxes on the 5% interest on your hard-earned investments, okay, and then after watching inflation consuming 3 to 8% of your savings while you were trying to get 5 to 6 to 7% interest in some of your conservative investments and being taxed on that and being inflated on that because government inflates in order to reduce the value of your money in those puny little savings accounts out there. And now you finally have a tiny little bit of heritage to pass on to your kids. And now, of course, the government steps in and says, now, wait, we're gonna tax all of that. Now the base federal tax on inheritance is 35%. 35%. Now, what used to be as high as 55%, but George W. Bush was able to bring that down a little bit. And of course, Barack Obama and others have been fighting to bring it back and fighting to bring it back. And we've got it back this year, 2011, for the first time since George W. Bush took it away or diminished inheritance taxing. Well, add to that the fact that you've got 10 to 15% imposed by state governments and your $300,000 of savings is now down to a measly $100,000 and your five kids get a measly $20,000 per child. It's hardly much of an inheritance. And oh, by the way, 95% of Americans will not receive anything substantial from their parents in inheritance. Okay, so that's the vision of the left, and that's how the family is disintegrated. And generation by generation, we are squeezing the life, the economic life, out of the nuclear family in this country. And of course, the nuclear family now makes up less than half of American households as of the year 2009. Well, our institutions are doing what they can to squeeze the living daylights out of the nuclear family. The family institution is dying, it's dying, it's dying. But there are some of us who are establishing what we call islands of freedom. There are some of us with some vision. There's some of us who want to get a clue. There's some of us who want to find ways to merge out of the present socialist system, that it does what it can, that does what it can on the macro level to make sure that the family will be non-existent by the year 2040. A good man leaves an inheritance for his children's children. Folks, today we're going to get a vision concerning this. We're going to get a clue. We're going to find some ways in which you can save an inheritance for your children's children. Adam Brink is a CPA, and he's got some great ideas in the area of trusts. It's time to find islands, islands of freedom.
so that we, as those with a little bit of vision and a desire to salvage the family in the next generation, will have an opportunity to do just that. That's next on Generations. Stay with me.
I have always felt that doubt was the beginning of wisdom, and the fear of God was the end of wisdom.
Clarence Darrow.
The only true wisdom is knowing that you know nothing.
Socrates.
Belief is the death of intelligence.
Robert Anton Wilson.
If thou trusteth to the book called the Scriptures, thou trusteth to the rotten staff of fables and falsehood.
Thomas Paine.
Faith is believing what you know ain't so.
Mark Twain.
Whoever trusts in his own mind is a fool, but he who walks in wisdom will be delivered.
God.
The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight.
God.
The fool believes his own ideas to be wisdom, but those who fear God and search for understanding find true wisdom. To lead your family in the pursuit of godliness, pick up a copy of the Proverbs Study Guide at generationswithvision.com.
Welcome back to the Generations Broadcast. Kevin Swanson, your host, with you. Today we want to talk about preserving inheritance, preserving our family economies. We're a huge believer in family economies on this program, which means we build up the financial family strength, the sorts of things that are talked about in Psalm 128 and 127. God blesses our families with fruitfulness. We're looking after our herds and our flocks quite well. Another proverb, if you read our proverb study guides, you're aware of some of these proverbs. But these are things that our families are very interested in doing. A good man saves an inheritance for his children's children. And how are we going to do this if the forces around us do everything they can to undermine the family solidarity and to disintegrate the family economically, socially, educationally, and every other way? Well, to talk about this issue of inheritance and trusts and these sorts of things, Adam Brink is a friend I made in Sacramento at a conference we both attended a couple of weeks ago. Adam is a homeschooling father of four. He's a CPA, and he's got a lot of background, a lot of specialties in the area of trusts and estates. Adam, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Kevin. Glad to be on the program.
It's good to have you here. And, you know, you opened my eyes to some things I wasn't aware of. As I told you, I'm very concerned about Barack Obama or somebody else who is anti-inheritance taxing the living daylights out of my future inheritance. And I want to find ways to preserve our inheritance here in my own family. Now, I've used the gift tax exemption from time to time, and I'm going to continue to use that, I believe. But we've got to find ways to salvage our inheritance, and our present system doesn't really help us too much, does it?
Well, it's surprising when you mention people like Barack Obama. We often think of the tax codes based on, you know, the 1040 tax return everybody has to file every year, or a corporation tax return that they'd be filing, or partnerships and what have you. But it's interesting, the legal structures that have been created in America are very unfavorable if you're utilizing your Social Security number, working as a W-2 employee, going about your business. There are, it really hits hard on the middle classes.
Mm-hmm. And over time, you suffer because of all of those systems. I mean, you're paying your taxes on both incomes. You're paying Social Security taxes. You may even pay an estate tax or inheritance tax at the end. But there are taxes everywhere, and families just have a harder time getting ahead these days.
Yes, we certainly do. Now, one of the interesting things about both federal and state laws, every state I've researched, I just researched your state this morning, Colorado, every state that I've researched so far has very favorable laws for irrevocable trusts, which that's what I like to help people out with, is figure out how can they use a trust to preserve their assets during their career and upon their demise, and they want to pass on an inheritance to their children and their children's children. They want to fund charitable projects that they believe in, not that somebody else has voted in. And trusts are a way, depending on the situation and circumstances, where someone can really preserve a lot more of their assets and direct their usage in a way that their conscience is at ease with.
The trust is an amazing little tool. And why don't you give us a little history on the trust? It's been around for centuries.
Sure. Yeah, actually, we in America inherited the trusts and the laws about trusts from the English common law. And in fact, if you read a standard textbook on trust, they will identify the statute of uses in the times of Henry VIII as part of American law that teaches us what we should think about trusts. And Henry's purpose was to actually stop trusts because it was lowering the income tax base or the fee base that he would receive. But it backfired because before that, the Normans had begun to heavily tax the people after the Battle of Hastings, after they came over and took over the British monarchy. They began to tax everyone, and they would send a guy off to war. He would die in war fighting for his king, and then they would put his property under fealty. So the church created trusts outside of the courts of law. They created them to transfer all of the man's assets into trust, so that should he die during battle, all of the assets would be preserved for his wife, his children, his children's children, and in many instances, they also named beneficiaries as monasteries or churches or whatever, which is how the monasteries got so wealthy in England, for instance. But that's an entirely different subject. They were helping people to avoid unnecessary taxes, and this happened for 300 years without recognition in the courts of law.
It's effectively a balance of powers between the people, the families, the church, and the state. The state, of course, always wanting to gain as much power as possible, the power to tax, the power to tyrannize. And of course, this is the inclination in the hearts of natural man to centralize power and money. And we've got to find ways in which we balance that out by strengthening families. And I guess the trust is one way to do that.
It is, definitely. And if you think of the model of stewardship, that's exactly how the Christians who created trusts were thinking. I am a steward of assets. I manage these assets for the benefit of future generations. I don't own these assets. That's the neat thing about trusts, is they take ownership. And when I say I got a W-2 job and I'm earning, you know, $50,000 a year, that's my money. I own it. It's attached to my Social Security number. When a trust takes in receipts, the way that it works is the asset is owned in two ways. It's owned where the legal title vests in the trust, meaning the name of the trust or the employee ID number is associated with that asset for legal ownership purposes. But the beneficial ownership is for the benefit of whoever the named beneficiaries are. That could be the children of the settler of the trust or the person who settles or creates the trust. He could name his children, he could name a church, he could name a charitable foundation, he could name, you name it, he could name that as a beneficiary as long as that entity or person can receive benefits. So what happens with the trust is, because it does this separation of ownership between the legal title and the beneficial title, the trustees who take the assets in legal title, they hold it as stewards for the benefit of other persons. Now, just think about how God created the world. He gave Adam the Garden of Eden as a trust, in a sense. He entrusted it to him. He gave him stewardship and dominion over it, not for his own ownership, not for his own benefit, but for the glory of God and for the good of his offspring, to, you know, it says to fill the earth and subdue it. So obviously the exercise of dominion and the stewardship he had of his assets was for the benefit of future generations. And the trusts really encourage that.
And that's what can happen with these trusts. So what sort of trusts are available for us today?
Now, there are different types of trusts. They can be used for holding real estate. They can be used for holding Federal Reserve notes or gold. They can be used to set up a foundation to provide scholarships or to provide for churches or missionaries. I mean, the sky is the limit. Any lawful purpose that's not immoral, like you can't set up a trust to murder someone. That's an invalid trust. But any lawful purpose can be pursued by a trust, and really the sky is the limit. Whatever you can imagine, you can do in a trust. And the nice thing about the tax codes, the way that America has structured its tax codes, is that trusts, If you look at the Colorado laws that I was just looking at this morning, or you look at California laws, I wrote a memo to the state of Maryland and to the IRS about some trusts and demonstrated that, you know, trusts don't have to have income unless the trust document requires it or the trustees vote that they have income. So a trust, under the laws of federal, and I can quote them if you'd like me to, or I can just discuss what they say, and people can contact me if they want to know further detail, but the trust laws are so favorable to trust that a trust gets to determine whether or not it has income. It could have $1 million of receipts, but the trustees, under the terms of the governing instrument and applicable local laws, usually state laws, that will help them determine whether or not they actually have income. Now, it's all dependent on how the trust agreement is written, how the trustees vote, what the purposes of the trust are, et cetera. So there's some qualifying factors. But if people get a hold of this, what they're going to have to do is say, I'm not going to own these assets, because that's the difference between, say, a revocable trust, where the person retains control over the assets and trust, which most people will have for when they die.
Right.
And then once they die, it becomes an irrevocable trust. And then the assets are treated just like what I'm talking about with the irrevocable trust. Irrevocable means you cannot revoke your donation of those assets. Once you settle the trust, whatever you put in there belongs to the trust. It does not belong to you. You can't tell the trustees what to do with it, except in the trust agreement or the indenture, the trust contract. That's their Bible. That's their governing instrument. That tells them how to behave with those assets, what sort of charities you'll support, the trust will support, you know, how the assets are to be divvied up between beneficiaries. Will there be income beneficiaries? Will there be remainder beneficiaries? Income beneficiaries mean you have to have income. Or they could say, you know, we used to pay X amount in taxes every year. We now want to give that to these charitable causes that we believe in. You know, so it's just a very empowering tool where people gain control over their assets. And this is something that the very wealthy have been doing.
What are the benefits, Adam, of putting your assets into a revocable trust? Can you avoid inheritance taxes, estate taxes, by doing that? Can you avoid probate? Is it generally preferred to have your assets or your more important assets in a revocable trust?
Okay, so the irrevocable is similar to when a person dies and their assets are settled into a trust estate. Basically, that completely creates a new legal person. So if I settle $1 million into trust, that trust is now a new legal person, an irrevocable trust. If I die, it's completely irrelevant to the activities of that trust. In other words, there's no need to even consider inheritance at that point, because it's almost like you rewound your death and you donated those assets into the irrevocable trust. Now it has a life of its own, completely apart from the settlor of the trust or the person who creates or settles the trust. That person is now irrelevant so far as inheritance, et cetera. So there's no inheritance tax to consider once assets are donated into trust.
What about the revocable trust?
Revocable trust, the way that that works is you can still avoid probate, which is very good. What you don't get are the additional statutory benefits for whether or not, so if, say somebody owns five houses and they're renting out those five houses and they have it all in a revocable trust. Well, that's the same as owning it on your Social Security number, which exposes you to liability for each one of those properties. You have a suit on one property, you could lose all five. What an irrevocable trust does is it separates each one into its own separate person. You have a suit on one, you lose the assets in the one. That's one benefit. The other benefit is it's no longer part of your estate, which then gets assessed, because the way that the probate works is if you have it in a revocable trust, you bypass probate, but you don't necessarily bypass the inheritance tax completely, because there'll still be limitations that they'll put on what assets, how they assess assets, and depending on the size of a person's estate, that could have serious consequences. The irrevocable trust, since it's a separate person, you bypass the probate, you also bypass the inheritance tax, you know, go past, what is it in the game Monopoly, go past Go, and past jail and collect $200 or whatever. You know, you just you bypass the whole thing. It doesn't catch you at all.
With the irrevocable trust, is it possible to distribute any part of that irrevocable trust to beneficiaries?
Yes and no. Now, if you distribute assets to them like a salary to a beneficiary, then they have to be taxed on that. Now, what I advocate is for the beneficiaries, if you have sizable enough assets, that if there's a point in time when the trust wants to wind up and conclude its business and it wants to distribute,
yes,
it can take all the assets in trust and it can distribute it directly to a natural person, in which case the characteristics will be passed on through a K-1 and that person will get taxed. Or they could pass it on into another irrevocable trust, which then has the same tax advantages to decide whether or not the assets coming in have any income or no income. And so it ends up basically perpetuating the benefit of the tax law for the sake of this new trust that's set up. In other words, then there's no problem with that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, trust can be set up to cover the health, welfare, and maintenance of the beneficiaries. Which, when you think about, okay, well, what do I have to pay as my own personal expense? There are personal expenses that a trust cannot cover.
Mm-hmm.
And if a beneficiary or a trustee takes a fee, then they have to pay taxes on that.
Mm-hmm.
But a trust can be set up in such a way that it can cover many things that people take for granted as being their own personal expenses, but the way a trust is structured, depending on how it's structured, what it says and who it names as beneficiaries and what its purposes are, it could conceivably cover some of those things and eliminate the need for somebody to take out assets that they own as their own. The trust basically could pay those and for the benefit of the beneficiaries using trust assets, no problem. But once you take out like a salary or a fixed fee or something, then you're talking,
have
to pay the income tax.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it.
Adam Brink is a CPA and his specialty is trust and estates. I want to talk just for a little bit on Social Security, Adam. Social Security taxation is one of the most onerous forms of taxation. I mentioned to one group that I'm able to exempt at least part of my income thanks to my the fact that I am a pastor. I receive some income from a church, and there is that exemption that's still viable for a few. There's also the Amish exemption, which, by the way, occurred in September of 1961. Pretty amazing stuff here. I don't know if you've done history on this, but these guys referred to 1 Timothy 5:8 that if you don't provide your own household, you've denied the faith, you're worse than an infidel. The Amish bishops cited that passage to the IRS commissioner, and they also had a petition. We as representatives of the Old Order Amish Mennonite Church do herein express our deep appreciation with grateful hearts. Do we recount the favors and consideration accorded our forefathers in the past? We believe in a supreme being and also the Constitution of the United States and feel Social Security Act and Old Age Survivors Insurance is abridging, infringing our religious freedom. We believe in giving alms to the church. According to Christ's teaching, it's been our Christian concern from birth of our church group to supply those of our group who have a need, financial or otherwise. Our faith has also been sufficient to meet the needs as they come about. We bishops, representatives of the Old Order Churches of the USA, are appealing to you to prayerfully consider and reconsider this favor. In God we trust. Okay, that came out in 1961. By 1965, the Medicare bill passed through Congress exempted the Old Order Amish, and they have been exempted ever since. So, I mean, that was history. That was in 1965 when that happened. Sadly, many, many other Christians are not exempted from Social Security. So how does the average Christian deal with this? Somebody asked me this question at our recent Family Economics Conference. How do they exempt? How can they exempt from Social Security? Is there any way to do that?
Well, from what I've studied, it's an excellent point. Now, just as a plug for trust, trusts don't pay Social Security tax because they don't have a Social Security number, so they can't be assessed with the 15% Social Security tax.
Okay.
So trusts could have receipts of billions of dollars and have no Social Security tax, which I think it actually caps at about $90,000.
Mm-hmm.
They stop assessing the Social Security tax.
Right.
Now, so that's a plug for trusts. Trusts have no Social Security tax assessed. In the second place, you asked about how can people exempt themselves.
Yeah.
From what I understand, what I've researched, and I can't claim expertise on this, but from what I've seen and from what I understand, any group or association can opt out of Social Security. And I don't recall what exactly the majority or how many what other, you know, what the percentage is of the whole. But, for instance, the teachers' union, they have exempted themselves from Social Security, but they have to provide an alternative source of investments for themselves. So they did that, and it's really funny because they're the one of the more Marxist organizations, and yet they don't don't even live up to their own principles. People in Congress have done the same thing. A county represents a group of people that can do that sort of thing. It can exempt itself if the citizens of the county vote that way. I would like to see certified public accountants do that, but they haven't done it yet. So there are groups of people who, if they represent a constituency among the population, they can actually vote to get themselves out of Social Security.
Also, the old law from 1965 literally states here, any other religious sect who conscientiously objected to insurance from paying Social Security payments, providing that that sect had been in existence since December 31st, 1950. So there it is, right in the middle of this law passed and signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson on August 13th, 1965. So I have a feeling there are ways to create what I call islands of freedom here and there. And you see this. I mean, you do see it. You see examples of people who are able to create some kind of freedom and hopefully establish a little more solidarity economically for future families and Christian organizations. And we saw that with the Christian medical sharing ministries that were exempted in the recent healthcare bill. I don't know if you watched that whole thing play out, but the House version of the bill was the one that made it through. And sure enough, it was the little Samaritan ministries that were exempted by in that language. And we were just celebrating. We're praising God for these exemptions. And I think what we're seeing is that where there's a will, there's a way. Where people want to be free, it is possible. You can be free. You can fight for it, but it's going to take a little bit of creativity, and you've got to, I think, take in multiple counselors here, probably get some legal counsel as well. We certainly are not trying to provide legal counsel on this edition of Generations, but there are ways. The point is there are ways to make it and to establish strong family economies and hopefully provide a good inheritance for our children's children.
Yes, absolutely. I feel like trusts are one of those ways that people can look into. And frankly, the people that I like to help with this are people who have their own businesses, who are working under contracts. They're not working with the traditional W-2 employment. That's very difficult, if not impossible.
Yeah.
You have to be an independent type of person. Your work has to be independent. And then trusts can really be powerful, because then you're operating under the laws of contracts, which is exactly how trusts are created. Under the law of contracts, the Constitution actually guarantees the right to contract, that no state can make any law prohibiting the duties and rights of contracts. And so trusts are merely one of those things that fall under the law of contracts, whereby people can make agreements with one another to do lawful purposes, and nobody can make a law to prevent that. Now, as far as the taxes are concerned, the island of freedom and the saving for future generations, the state of California, very interesting, their probate code tells you that a trust can defy the state of California and can have a provision within the trust governing document that is contrary to the requirements of California law. Now, your Colorado law says the same thing, as does Tennessee, Texas, Maryland, Montana, the states that I've looked at, every state I've looked at, the state laws, they adopt this Uniform Principal and Income Act. Principal is not taxable as income. Income is what we think of when we file our 1040 return. We have income. But the way the trusts are set up, they have this huge amount of discretion to say, well, we've got $1 million, but is that really income? Yes or no. Then the trustees get to vote on it, depending how the trust agreement is written. So it's a bastion of freedom. They've created this in order to help the super wealthy to continue to preserve their assets. And so the states have recognized this freedom for trusts. Trusts don't have to pay Social Security. They may or may not have income, depending on how the governing instrument is written. But really, when you think about it, they call it a governing instrument in their laws, federal and state, because they recognize that people are governing themselves when they establish a trust. They're governing their own activities. If you don't want to govern yourself, Well, of course, they have laws to govern you. The statutory laws require you to do certain things. But a trust is merely one way, similar in a sense to a prenuptial agreement, whereby you bypass the default statutory codes and you move into this area of contract law, which is, from what I can understand, far above the statutory laws, because people are then making contracts one with another, and that cannot be prohibited by any state law. So, yes, the trust is this kind of island that I think you're referring to.
Adam Brink is a CPA, and he works with trusts. For more information, people want to get in contact with you. How do they do that, Adam?
I wish I had a website up and running. I don't yet, but let me give you an email address. It's Brink, B-R-I-N-K, dot C-P-A, as in Certified Public Accountant, at gmail.com. Again, that's brink.cpa@gmail.com. And I can provide more information. I can offer a free consultation to figure out whether trusts would work for anyone in particular, what their circumstances are, and if they want to learn more about the code, or I have suggested reading and lectures for people to listen to, I'd be happy to pass that along.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to some concepts that may help you preserve your inheritance for your own families. And I would encourage you to consider revocable trusts or irrevocable trusts, as the case may be, and get in contact with Adam at brink.cpa@gmail.com. Adam, thanks again for joining us on Generations. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure talking to you.
And you have been listening to the Generations Radio broadcast, friends, as we talk about all sorts of ideas. But again, let me encourage you to get lots of counsel, get some accountants, get some legal counsel if you're heading into new territory for yourself. But consider revocable trusts, irrevocable trusts. Consider gift tax exemptions. Consider some of these things. Get creative and look for options, alternatives, ways in which perhaps you could avoid some of the tyrannical systems that are around us. That's one reason why we go with Samaritan Medical Sharing Plan instead of going with some of our other forms of insurance and of course, the mandated programs that are coming down the pike from the federal government. Folks, you can interact with the program by emailing me directly at host@kevinswanson.com. You can also hear the program anytime, anywhere in the world at kevinswanson.com. This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.